I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. Welcome back to the show. Today, we're joined by Dr. Matthew Martin, the regional executive at the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. As you know, when we bring on experts from the Federal Reserve System, our goal is to understand what's happening in the broader economy, how it impacts households and businesses, and what we should prepare for as we move toward a new economic cycle. From inflation to interest rates, consumer spending to the strength of our labor market, and even how all of this shows up for families and small businesses here in North Carolina, we're covering it all today. Dr. Martin, thank you for locking in, man. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
It is. You know, you're going to do me a favor today, Dr. Martin. I always tell my audience I've got friends in high places. I don't know if they always believe me, but here we are. We've got an actual official on the show from the Federal Reserve Bank, and I'm so grateful to be reconnected. For my audience that may not know, Dr. Martin and I go back many, many years. We both served on the North Carolina Council on Economic Education, along with Sandy Wheat, and just the amazing work that she's been doing at a state level when it comes to financial and economic literacy, helping our teachers learn how to teach financial literacy. I think it's some of the most important work, Dr. Martin, that's being done throughout our state. Are you still associated with the North Carolina Council? Are you still a part of that mission and that effort?
I am, and we still host the Quiz Bowl and I think one other event in our offices here in Charlotte.
That is incredible. I've always admired Sandy and had a chance to meet her at a luncheon many years ago. She immediately recruited me to the council. And I think I did a couple of terms with her, and that was just some really great work to do. So big shout out to Sandy Wheat and just the amazing work you're doing across the state of North Carolina. You know, Dr. Martin, the Federal Reserve has been in the spotlight all year long. We are coming up on a changing of the guard of the Federal Reserve. I guess you're not on the short list, are you, to be the new president, are you? Or chairman, I suppose.
I am not in consideration. No.
Not in consideration. Okay. All right. Well,
I'm comfortable working here out of Charlotte and covering the Carolinas. This is a good job.
No, all jokes aside, Dr. Martin, I think this year conversation around the Federal Reserve Bank has been an all-time high. For my audience that may not fully understand the mission and the main purpose of the Federal Reserve Bank, just talk a little bit about broadly sort of what the mandate of the Federal Reserve is.
Yeah, we've actually got several roles we play. I think the newsy part is the monetary policy piece, right? Where you have seven governors of the Board of Governors in D.C. and then 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, each with a president. And there's 19 people make up the committee that decides monetary policy. And in any given year, 12 of them actually vote on policy. So, and we're trying to accomplish two things: keep inflation low and stable and promote maximum employment. That's our dual mandate, as it's called. But we're also involved in some other stuff, particularly out of the Charlotte office. We got a large number of bank examiners due largely to the large banks here in town, Bank of America and Truist. We've got others, though, that we're responsible for. So that's a big piece of what we do. And then we're involved in payments. Charlotte's got one of the larger cash operations in the Federal Reserve System. We just last year rolled out a real-time payment system, FedNow. And then there's other payment systems as well, ACH and wire transfers, if folks are familiar with those. So we've got a number of roles.
And Dr. Martin, when we hear that the Federal Reserve Bank is broken up into these districts that we hear about, like the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, talk more about the districts and the purpose behind the various regional districts that are created.
Yeah, it's a good question. So if you go back, we were created by congressional law right around Christmas in 1913, opened our doors in 1914. So the distribution of the banks reflects the population and business concentrations around the country. Basically, the Northeast was much more concentrated people and business-wise. So the districts in the Northeast are smaller. There's a Boston, New York, Philly, Richmond. So we're all kind of clustered, and then they're more spread out in the West. But the idea was that through the Panic of 1907, What helped there was the New York Clearinghouse basically acting like a bank examiner and a lender of last resort. And so different cities had these clearinghouses, and the idea of creating the Federal Reserve was to have a national clearinghouse system that any bank could be a part of. The other benefits of that, though, is we have 12 reserve banks plus 24 branch offices, so a bunch of locations around the country, and there's someone like me in each of those places, or more than one of me. And we're all reaching out to the business community. We're all having real-time conversations about how the economy's doing. It's more timely than the data. It's more nuanced. It gives much more context. And when you go through a period like we just came through where the federal government is not providing the data we're used to getting, those insights are even more important for understanding how the economy's doing. So it's a really important on-the-ground apparatus for understanding the economy.
And when you look at the Fed's goals, maintaining stable prices and maximum employment, how do you assess the Fed's performance over the past couple of years? I mean, is the system where you feel like it needs to be, or?
Well, I mean, if you look at it, and there's been lots of commentary from Chair Powell and others in recent weeks about this. Inflation, we have a stated target of 2% inflation. Inflation's running above that. About 2.7% as of the last data, but that's down. You know, if you go back a couple of years through COVID, inflation really soared as we had some supply chain issues and some other things going on. So we've made a lot of progress back toward that. And unemployment right now as of the last reading is at 4.4%, pretty close to what most estimates are of full employment. So there are risks to both of those, but so far the economy is holding up pretty well and on the whole is in pretty good shape.
You know, we always hear this inflation target of 2%. And, you know, we hear that on all the news shows and, you know, a lot of times Chairman Powell talks about it as well. Where did that inflation target come from? I mean, who came up with the number 2%? And is there some science, I guess, behind that?
Yeah, there's no magic behind it. There is some science. If you go back to when inflation targets started to show up in central banks' mandates around the world, and a lot of central banks around the world don't have a dual mandate, they just have the inflation mandate. You don't want inflation to be zero, or at least this has been the thinking, in part because you might have some mismeasurement, right? And if, in particular, back in the 90s, there was research that showed standard measures of inflation tended to overstate inflation for a number of reasons. So you don't want to be zero. So you have to think of something that's not too high, but that is sort of maintainable. And so 2% is where central banks settled on. Some have ranges around that, right? They're not specifically 2%. But it's the kind of thing that gets revisited periodically. And earlier this year, or back in August, the Federal Reserve reiterated its 2% target.
Well, when you look at a country the size of America, and you also, you know, walked us through how the Federal Reserve Bank is broken up into these various districts. And I think you could make the argument that the various districts and the regions perform a little bit different than mm-hmm. others. I mean, the performance of the economy out in the West Coast is going to be different than what you see in middle America. Does it make sense to have a 2% inflation target that is sort of one size fits all for the entire country? Or does it also, I mean, has it been some consideration in the past of looking at an inflation target that's more regional in nature?
I thought you were going to go down on the unemployment side, because that varies quite a bit region by region. But you're right. Cost of living and prices can vary, especially if you think of like housing, right? Not housing price changes or rental growth, if you're talking multifamily. It's not the same everywhere. So, yeah, there's some variability. But, you know, in a lot of goods and services, they follow similar trends no matter where you are across the country. So you can dial in pretty good. And I would note, Bureau of Labor Statistics does report regional inflation trends as well. So if there were a real issue there, it would show up in the data. I worry more about it on the labor market side, particularly as we are now when we're in a position where housing markets are kind of, I wouldn't say frozen, but there aren't many homes being sold or bought, and people aren't moving as much as they used to in the past, which means if you have a region that's growing really quickly, and North Carolina is part of that, it might make it harder for people to move to where the jobs are. And so you can have big variations in unemployment rates.
That's an interesting point. Now, is that something that the Federal Reserve Bank is looking at? I mean, in terms of changing how you view that data? Or
it's important for us to understand the variability there. But I tell people we've got one tool. We change an overnight interest rate. It's a very blunt instrument. There are other policies on the fiscal side that maybe would provide some assistance in those sorts of circumstances. We really don't have the tools to address it, but it's important to understand it for sure.
And just for clarification from our audience, when you say other policies on the fiscal side, you mean from legislation, because a lot of what you're dealing with is more monetary policy, not necessarily the fiscal policy, correct?
That's right. We change a short-term interest rate. We have some other, the last couple of business cycles, we've done some things with our balance sheet, but primarily we're adjusting a short-term interest rate to try and meet both sides of our mandate.
You mentioned a moment ago that you look at the unemployment rate, you feel like we're at full employment. However, I've seen a number of pretty significant layoff announcements here recently, whether it's from a beef production facility like Tyson that's laying off 3,000 people. You hear about some of the layoffs occurring within the tech sector as AI and artificial intelligence expands more into that space. So it does feel like the labor market is starting to cool off, at least from my perspective. You know, from your perspective, do you feel like the labor market is softening? And if so, do you think it's happening in a moderated, healthy kind of way?
So if you go back 12, 18 months, probably the single most frequent comment I got from business leaders was they couldn't find the workers they needed. They don't make that comment near as often today. So I think you're right. The labor market has cooled off. And I think where it is now, it's probably on the whole roughly in balance. Hiring is down quite a bit, but firing really hasn't picked up a lot. So we're in this low hire, low fire environment, which is different. It was, a year ago, it was lots of hire, lots of people leaving for better pay, that sort of thing. And now instead of job leaving, they talk about job hugging, right? People are hugging the job that they have and staying put. But most everybody who wants a job still has one. It's been harder this year for college graduates and some others to find work. But I'd say we're close to the labor market being balanced. I do worry about layoff activity. AI could, in some cases, replace existing workers. Think of call centers. Most companies now have an AI chatbot to handle that. So they're probably not hiring or laying off. But I don't see a big pickup in layoff activity at this point. So it's something worth watching, but it still seems okay. And then if we get to the Carolinas, it's totally different story, right? We're growing pretty quickly.
Yeah, I'm even starting to see artificial intelligence get into a lot of entry-level positions, restaurants and, obviously warehousing. When you look at what Amazon is doing, and, they've been very clear that, over the next several years that they plan to deploy more artificial intelligence within their warehouses. And I think that's going to constrain the job market even further. When you hear that the labor market is starting to cool and companies are not hiring as much or not at the pace they were before, that typically indicates that the economy or the growth within the economy is also starting to slow as well. When you stand back and look at the economy right now, do you describe the economy as slowing, or do you even feel like maybe the economy is starting to stagnate a little bit?
If you look at GDP, I think growth is is fairly steady. It's been decent this year. And you can look at forecasts like the September meeting for the Federal Open Market Committee. They put out a forecast. We'll get one at the December meeting again. And it basically showed trend growth. Now, underlying that, I think growth is probably more focused on the AI build out and certain sectors. So I don't think it's even across all parts of the economy. But it's decent. It's just not with a lot of job growth. And so as an economist, when you look at it and say, okay, I've got decent growth, but not much job growth, then there must be productivity enhancements, right? And I think that's what bridges the gap, is we're in a period where productivity growth looks like it's pretty strong, and for the foreseeable future looks like it's going to stay that way, which is good in the sense it helps raise living standards, but it's got this trade-off in that you don't get as many new jobs, net new jobs being created. So that's how I square that circle. If we get to the point where the economy weakens for one reason or another and you get layoffs, that's a little bit different, but something has to really trigger that, I think.
Well, I like that word you use, uneven, because even when you look at the market or you look at the economy, the macro economy, I think a lot of things are uneven. And when you look at a handful of companies that are deploying all this new artificial technology, that appears to be where the growth is. But when you look at small to middle market companies and businesses, especially here in North Carolina, I still hear a lot of crying and gnashing of the teeth around labor and growth and so many different things. So I think you're spot on when you use the word uneven. But I want to come back to something you just said about raising the living standards, because I know someone in my audience just heard that, and I just want to clarify that. If we're going into a phase where productivity is being gained through artificial intelligence, meaning more people are losing their jobs, but we're just, still getting the same production, but just with more technology, if more people are losing their jobs, I would think that that's going to hurt confidence, consumer confidence. And it certainly would hurt consumption, because you would have less money, less dollars to go out and be able to consume in the economy. So I guess square for me, how does those productivity gains lead to a rise in living standards?
Well, let me tackle the near term part first. We don't have an excessive amount of layoffs at this point. So every month there's, and this is very rough numbers, you've got a labor force of like 160 million. And on average, every month, something like 4+ million lose jobs or leave and 4+ million get jobs. And we report that net figure. But there's a lot of churn in the labor market over time, right? Hopefully over time, that net number is we're adding jobs, especially if we're having population growth. So I want to clarify that. Over time, over a long period of time, the free lunch in the economy is productivity growth. So if you go look at the last 100 years and what the standard of living was then, or even go back 30 or 40 years, average household income, all that stuff is in real terms, in terms of what households can buy, that has increased quite a bit. And it's largely because it's exclusively because we have productivity growth. The average worker is more productive and gets paid more as a result. Now, along with that, and I think this is where a lot of the angst comes in, particularly if you start talking about AI, is technology changes the type of jobs out there, right? So technology, AI in this case, is going to cause some jobs to go away, but it's going to create other jobs. And the hard part is you might have a skills mismatch, right? And need to get workers who lost job in one sector retrained to go in a different one. And that might be really difficult. But your alternative is for the economy never to become more productive and become stagnant. And then you're just somewhere else around the world is going to do stuff better. And we end up losing out over the long run. So you don't want to prevent technological change, but that kind of growth through technological change presents challenges. And I think, and you might have a question on this, I mean, we have some broader issues on income disparity now anyhow, and we'll see how AI plays out, but there's some chance it exacerbates that to some degree.
Well, I like what you say about sort of the whole workforce development aspect of it, because, we saw that coming in the 90s, as the internet and technology became more prevalent, people had to learn new skills. You had to learn how to code. You had to learn how to become a programmer, learn how to work on computers. So hopefully that actual training and that transition keeps pace with the speed of what we're seeing in artificial intelligence. My fear is that it might not, is that the AI expansion feels like it's moving so rapidly, so quickly. I know just here in the last couple of years, I use artificial intelligence more than I would have ever thought I would have. I mean, if you told me 2 years ago that I would be using ChatGPT and some of the AI tools as frequently as I do, I just wouldn't have believed it. So it does feel like it's moving at a rapid pace. You know, switching gears a little bit, you know, the other big conversation all year long has been tariff policy. And it certainly has created a lot of uncertainty, not only within the economy, but also in the markets. You're out talking to companies and businesses across North Carolina. What impact have you seen this year on supply chains, business costs, or maybe even overall inflation, if any?
Yeah, the tariffs have, because they've changed over time, there's some uncertainty there. I think businesses have spent some time trying to figure out how to deal with tariffs. Over the course of the year, what I've seen is, go back to the spring when some of these tariffs were first introduced. It was a bit of a surprise to most businesses. And until they had time to figure out how they were going to react, that uncertainty caused a lot of concern. Over time, some of the tariffs have sort of settled in a little bit more, but probably more importantly, firms have had a chance to figure out how they're going to respond. And so I think, not that the tariffs don't raise costs or cause issues, but I think a lot of firms have figured out how they're going to deal with it, and they're moving forward. Some are still working this out, particularly if they have a particular input or something that's harder to change the sourcing, and so they've got to import it, and it's gone up a lot in price. They're having a hard time with those costs. And then it becomes an issue, well, if my costs have gone up, can I charge more for my prices to recover those costs? And that's, I think, pretty mixed. So a lot of businesses are having their margins between what they charge and what their costs are shrink quite a bit. And I think what's consistent, particularly the closer you get to the consumer, the harder it is to pass along those costs generally. And what consumer-facing firms have generally said is, we're going to raise some price now, but we're going to try this again a couple of times through 2026 to see if we can restore our margins, because they want to get back to the same level of profitability that they had been at. And it's going to take time. So I think clearly you can see in goods prices that inflation has picked up a little bit, and it's one of the headwinds in trying to get inflation back to 2%. But I think some of that's going to persist into 2026 as well.
You know, right now, inflation is moving somewhere nearly 3%. I've seen some economic reports that state that somewhere around 75 basis points of what we're seeing in inflation right now may be coming from the tariffs. Is that something you would agree or disagree with?
Reports I've seen are lower than that, the economic studies. But, you know, probably 30 basis points is probably reasonable, and there's always measures of uncertainty around that. So it's a headwind. But again, if that's only part of the pass through to consumers, you know, maybe we're going to see more of it as we get into next year.
You know, today is Cyber Monday. I probably shouldn't say that since I'm recording my actual show, but today is Cyber Monday. And this past Friday was Black Friday. We also had Small Business Saturday. This might be too early for you, but we're already starting to see reports that in terms of shopping numbers over the past few days for holiday shopping, I mean, we're at all-time highs. Consumers are spending more going into this holiday season than they ever have. It, you know, despite all the uncertainty that we've heard about in the economy throughout the year, despite the impact of tariffs on imports that are coming into the country, it just seems like the consumer, at least in this country, is very resilient, unbroken. What do you think is actually driving that resilience? And do you expect it to continue into 2026?
The consumer is resilient. As with most households, we spend, you know, a good chunk of our monthly budget is on stuff that that is recurring, right? You got to pay the rent, the utilities, the car payment, buy the groceries. So that kind of spending has lots of momentum. The only time you really see consumer spending fall is during recessions when unemployment goes up. And I think that's the key. Again, layoffs aren't really elevated. They are in a couple of places, but not overall. So everybody still has a job, and that job is getting, they'll get some pay increases going into next year. And I think congressional legislation will help, right? The tax cuts were extended. I've seen a lot of commentary that says, hey, they're probably going to have good tax refund levels this year, and that's going to support growth. Payroll deductions are going to be pretty low. So it looks like there's some support, again, as long as the labor market is roughly in balance and people have jobs.
You know, Dr. Martin, you and I are big proponents of financial literacy. So when I talk about the resilience of the consumer and, you know, record holiday sales and all of the activity that we continue to see, what do you, in your position as regional executive of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, what are you seeing in terms of savings levels? What are you seeing in terms of credit card debt? Are those things also increasing and dropping as this consumer resiliency stays in place?
Yeah, there's actually a good quarterly report that the New York Fed puts out on consumer credit. And you can see for both credit card portfolios and auto loans that delinquencies on those are elevated. When I talk to the auto lending people, they'll say, particularly in cars bought in 21 and 22, the delinquency rates are pretty high. But what you don't see, so this is not 2008, is you do not see any pickup in delinquencies for either first mortgages or home equity line of credit stuff. That stuff seems pretty low. So my read on that, and we've known this for a long time, is that first low income and now more moderate income households, they're stretched, right? Cost increases mean they have to make choices. If the price of something goes up, they either buy less of it or they trade down to something else. And I think there's a lot of evidence in the economy of that sort of activity that's ongoing. And probably then some households that are a little bit more in financial trouble as a result.
Yeah. No, it's concerning because, you know, if we were to see anything like another great financial crisis, if we were to see anything like another global pandemic, especially with the federal government and the position that it's in terms of how much money it's already spent and where its debt level is, I'm just really concerned if we were to see anything blow up major in our economy or in our financial market right now. I don't really know how consumers would be able to power through it. And I'm not really convinced that the federal government would be able to step in the same way they did back in 2009 or perhaps maybe even in 2020. I'm not trying to be an alarmist here, but I mean, if you just look at the numbers, at some point, all this stuff doesn't add up. And it just feels like we've got to get into some type of an austerity program here where the federal government has to realize that it's got to start spending less. And to some degree, I know that our economy is so much powered by consumers, but we need individuals and families to start also realizing that saving some money and being prepared for a rainy day might not be the worst thing either. As we get ready to wrap up, Dr. Martin, I could talk to you, man, all afternoon. I'm such a nerd when it comes to these conversations and hearing about the data and the insights and everything. But I've got time for one more question. I want to bring it home to North Carolina. When you zoom in on North Carolina specifically, is there anything that stands out to you? I mean, how do you see our state performing right now compared to the national landscape? I know that the last several years, North Carolina has been recognized one of the best places to do business. But when you think about housing and population growth and all the things that are happening here in North Carolina, from your perspective, where do you feel like we sit right now?
The North Carolina economy is doing really well. It's one of the better performers in the country. We've had all these job announcements this year of companies that are either moving to the state or opening operations. So the pipeline for economic development looks strong, which means their jobs are showing up here, which means we need people to move here and we need houses for them. So we're We could always do better, I think, to build more housing. Housing affordability is a real issue we hear about everywhere. It doesn't matter if you're in the city or in the country. It's an affordability is an issue. And the solution to that is supply, build more homes, right? So we need to figure out a way to do better than we're doing that way, because we need people to move in and fill in those jobs that are showing up. So it's a good news story for North Carolina, I think. And it's a testament to the, you know, businesses want to come here because the business climate's right. The amenities are great. The weather's generally great, except for August, I would argue. And that's July, August, the only time of the year I want to be out of the state. And so there's a lot going for it. It really is. And for me, I have to take that into account when I think about the information I'm collecting. If I'm talking to someone who just operates in North Carolina, I have to temper that because they're probably going to feel a lot better about the economy than someone that's in a state that's not doing near as well.
Dr. Martin, thank you again for joining us and offering such valuable insight. These are complex issues, but conversations like this help us to stay grounded in facts and not fear. To everyone listening, I hope you stay informed, stay curious, and remember your economic decisions shape your financial future. Consider giving a donation to what we do here at Locked In so that we can continue to produce this free content for our community. But also make sure that you always stay locked in to WTOB, because every Sunday morning, that's where you can lock in with me. But if you happen to miss me there, hopefully you're subscribed to the podcast. You can get that on YouTube, Spotify, Pandora, Apple, wherever you like to get your favorite podcasts. I am always available there. And until next time, y'all stay locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WGC. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.